Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And now on Sunday night, it's time for the second part of our interview with historian Tom Holland, recently in Australia for writers' festivals in Perth and Adelaide. He dropped in for a conversation built around his books, Persian Fire, Rubicon, Millennium, and most recently a controversial look at the origins of Islam in The Shadow of the Sword. Tom Holland, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a controversy that has an echo of the past and one you've chosen to participate in. And this is as a result of your latest book, The Shadow of the Sword, in which you look at the emergence of Islam out of this period of late antiquity, but right into a contemporary argument that is about the nature of Islamic history and the history going back to the Prophet. This has caused you to be praised and vilified according to various circles of historiography.
The more that Muslims have become a part of the West, so the more that interest in Islam has risen. And over the past 40 years, really, the issue of the extent to which what Muslims believe about the life of Muhammad and about the beginnings of Islam, is this a matter of faith or is it a matter of history, has become an escalating area of debate among academics. To the degree that now, I would say, it is probably the single most contested area, not just in ancient history, but in any field of history, full stop. And to give you a sense of just how contested it is, the degree to which the very most basic contours of the debate are up for grabs. You can have scholars who spend a lifetime studying all the languages, all the material, and come to radically opposed conclusions. So you will get scholars who say, Muhammad was the prophet of God, and we can trust everything that the Muslim sources tell us about him. You can also get scholars who say Muhammad did not even exist, and the Quran emerged in Central Asia. And that is a huge spectrum of opinion. And it is a challenge to come to this period and realize that essentially there is no stable ground here. Now, what I wanted to do was to tell a narrative story, because that's what I always like to do. And that hasn't been done. No one has really done that before. And interestingly, the conditions of writing a narrative are rather different to those of scholars who do not bother with narrative. Because what I have to do as a narrative historian who is writing for people who are not specialists is that I have to explain what happens in terms of cause and effect. And it has to be human cause and effect. And the core fact is that in the 6th century, the Middle East is dominated by two ancient empires, a Persian empire in the east and a Roman empire in the west. And in the 7th century, it's the Roman Empire. It's ruled from Constantinople. And in the 7th century, the Roman Empire loses most of its Middle Eastern provinces. It's left a sort of bleeding, dismembered rump. And the Persian Empire is swallowed up whole. What happens? What's the explanation for this? The Muslim tradition is that the explanation for this is that Muhammad receives his revelations from God in the depths of a desert.
It's a thousand
kilometers from the frontier of Roman Palestine. Has nothing in a pagan environment. He gets these revelations. He gives them to his followers. The Arabs all become Muslim in the sense that we would now describe a Muslim. And inspired by Islam, they sweep out of the desert, and that is what enables them to defeat the Romans and the Persians. Now, if you are a Muslim and you are a believer, that explanation is absolutely fine. But if you're not, then it's clearly inadequate, because I can't say the reason that the Roman and Persian empires fell is because God wanted it to happen and because God gave Muhammad the Quran. And there are two reasons why I can't say that. I mean, you know, I could have been persuaded and become a Muslim and been convinced it's the only explanation. I didn't, because I think that there are two big problems with this story. The first is that the world that is conquered by the Arabs is one that is in an absolutely appalling condition. You don't need to invoke God to explain the fact that the Roman and Persian empires collapsed, because they have gone through a succession of calamities, one of which is, in the previous century, the eruption of a terrible plague, which recent scientific evidence suggests was probably bubonic. So there would have been absolutely no immunity, and the impact would have been even greater than that of the Black Death in the 14th century. And it's possible that anything between a third and a half of the population of these two empires were wiped out. And these are urban societies, and so the impact of the plague would have been much greater on the Romans and the Persians than on, say, the Arabs, who were all living in a desert. And that's devastating for these empires because it devastates their tax base and it wipes out their manpower. And so to carry on their fighting, they start recruiting Arabs to man their frontiers. And essentially, we know from archaeological evidence that the Roman frontiers of Palestine and Syria are just decommissioned. These forts are closed down and handed over to the Arabs. The Persians and Romans then fight a terrible war at the beginning of the 7th century. Absolutely devastating. For a generation, the Romans lose control of Syria and Palestine. And although ultimately they get them back, when we say that the Romans are in control of Syria and Palestine, they are as in control of Syria and Palestine as, say, the Dutch were in charge of Indonesia after the Second World War, i.e. not very much. They're just a skeleton force. And so you can explain the Arab takeover in terms of the fact that they are already there and they just decide, why should we take orders from the Romans? Let's just take over. So I don't think that you need Islam to explain the fact that the Arabs are able to take over these empires, because you have this unique conjunction of circumstances that makes it possible.
Okay, you've given us the context, but still we have Islam as a faith emerging. That is, what is the material that makes this faith? We have the Quran, we have the Hadiths, we have all this material such that Gibbon was prepared to say you have more evidence for the historical veracity of Islam and the Prophet than you do for Jesus Christ.
Well, the problem with all that is that this source material is incredibly late. The earliest biography of Muhammad that we have, the earliest account of the Arab conquests, the earliest commentaries on how the Quran came into being, all date from about 800 AD. And Muhammad is meant to have died in 632. So it's more than 150 years afterwards. And that's a large gap in which we have no source material basically written by Muslims. And the issue then becomes, well, why don't we? And people always say, well, they were people who had an oral tradition. They just pass it down like that. But it's puzzling because they have conquered the most literate area in the world, in which there's absolutely no lack of people who are able to write things down. And from about 800, when we start getting these materials, suddenly there's a vast eruption. You know, you get biography after biography after biography. So that silence is very peculiar. And I think that the explanation for it, the reason that we don't have writings by Muslims until then, is because there aren't Muslims around to write it, because Islam is in the process of evolution. And I think that essentially what happens is that incredibly sophisticated religions like Islam cannot possibly emerge fully formed. They cannot sort of strike like lightning from a clear blue sky. And the problem that I have with the traditional accounts of how Islam come into being is precisely what for a Muslim is the proof that it's miraculous. Because according to Muslim tradition, Muhammad is illiterate. He lives in a place, Mecca, that is 1,000 kilometres from the frontier of the Roman Empire and where you get the Jews and the Christians. And he's in the middle, you know, surrounded by desert, and he's in a pagan environment, not a Jewish or Christian one. So therefore, the fact that he gets the Quran, which is shot through with references to Jewish and Christian figures, can only be explained as a miracle. But for me, that is precisely why the traditional account can't be true.
And this is why you're in trouble with many people, because you are actually saying that the Hadith, even the Quran itself, cannot be traced back to the Prophet and his immediate followers.
I think the Quran can be traced back to the Prophet, but that doesn't mean that I think that the Prophet is in some, you know, that it originates with him, because I think that there are probably elements within the Quran that are much older. Because what's very interesting about it, that far from being a sort of completely new beginning, as Muslim tradition says that it's something that emerges in the desert purity, it's full of references to Christian gospels that have been forgotten elsewhere in Christendom by this point, to Jewish sayings, to stories of Alexander the Great, accounts of Christian martyrs, even sort of faint hints of pagan myth and even phrases from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's like a sort of compendium of the greatest hits of antique religion. And they've all been blended and fused to create something extraordinary and new. But the constituent elements, it seems to me, are absolutely coming from the Middle East of the period. And that's why the big debate really among academics and specialists, which I'm sort of trying to bring to a sort of broader audience, because I think it's so interesting, it can be summed up by this. Is the Quran a late antique text? That's what the scholars say, by which they mean, is the Quran something that recognisably emerges from the sort of the melting pot of faiths and civilizations that exists in the Middle East? Or does it emerge, as Muslim tradition says, in a pagan city in the middle of a desert? And I know which is more plausible to me.
Independent of all of that, you're making another and wider claim that stretches across this cycle of books, that in some ways our civilization, East and West, is a shared heritage, and it's a dynamic tension that resonates through 3,000 years. And in some ways, religion, that is, ties that bind, are essential to the nature of a dynamically successful civilization.
Well, I think, I guess that one theme that I would have is that although, obviously, we are aware of ourselves as the heirs of the Greeks and the Romans, and we really emphasise that, the other civilization that's had an incalculable effect on all of us, both East and West, is the Persians. And the reason for that is that the Persians, way back before the time of Muhammad and Jesus even, you know, right the way back to the 5th century BC, the period when they are busy attacking the Greeks and, wiping out the Spartans at Thermopylae, the innovation that the Persians represent is this idea that that the world can be understood in terms of good and evil. And this is something very original and new. And it means that if you're the king of an empire that believes this, you can cast your empire as being the agent of virtue and rightness and morality and order and truth. And of course, your enemies then become agents of an axis of evil. And the influence of that is obviously still with us to this day.
And what gives that particular power is monotheism.
Yes.
Once you have one God who brings this order into coherent, visible shape,
yes,
then that gives it even more
yes
strength.
And so I think that the history of monotheism is something that we can see it starting with the Persian Empire in the 5th century BC. They have a sort of vague notion that the universe, like the world, is divided into rival spheres of good and evil. There are sort of two rival principles. So it's not quite monotheism. There's an all-good God and there's an all-bad God, and they are fighting, and it will only be resolved at the end of time. But you can see the influence of that on what becomes Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and particularly with the emergence of the Roman Empire as Christian. So when Constantine, the Roman Emperor, is meant to have a vision of Christ and of a cross in the sky, and he signs up to Christianity, what that then does is to give muscle to a particular faction within the Christian church, the dominant faction, and it enables the church to establish a sense of orthodoxy. It gives coherence to its doctrines and to its structure. And that then means that everyone else has to do that, because this is like a sort of an amazing evolutionary leap forward it's in sort of Darwinian terms. And it means that everyone else has to build up their defences in response. So it's from this period that the rabbis start taking control of Judaism, and the rabbis start building frontiers to keep the Christians out, and the Christians start building frontiers to keep the Jews out. And it means that what previously had been a no man's land, in which Christians could follow the Jewish law and Jews could believe that Jesus was the Messiah, that no man's land is gone, and you have these two rival religions. I think that it's this sort of the traditions of this no man's land in which Jews and Christians had met, that's sort of fenced off, and it's that's pushed to the margins, which means effectively in Palestinian terms, into the deserts of Arabia. And I think that then becomes the melting pot out of which what will become Islam finally emerges. And then it, of course, the same process happens again, that it takes a lengthy period of time for people to seize the commanding heights of what becomes Islam, so that by about 800 you have Judaism, Christianity and Islam all within their sort of their fortifications, and they are self-contained, distinct, have no contact with one another. But there were periods before that where that wasn't the case.
On Sunday night, we're speaking with historian Tom Holland, author of The Shadow of the Sword. Tom Holland, monotheism is an immensely powerful concept. It frees you from dependence on the physical presence of an empire because you're now united by an ideology, a sort of empire of the mind.
Yes, and you see what, and the brilliant thing about both Christianity and Islam, if you're looking at it from a sort of, you know, an evolutionist point of view, why are they so successful? Well, it's because it caters to different constituencies. So if you're an emperor and you can say that you're the agent of a single all-wise, all-good God, that's obviously brilliant. That's fantastic because it puts you in a really good light. And the Roman emperors call themselves the deputy of God. They are the agent of God. And that's what a caliph is. The caliphs are the deputies of God. So that's one side that caters to the ruling classes. But both Christianity and Islam also have another side, which is that the Sermon of the Mount says that, you know, the meek, the humble, the peaceful will inherit the world. And Islam says that God does not love the swaggering and the arrogant and fosters a notion of universal brotherhood. And that gives a kind of dignity to the vast mass of human beings who previously had not had that dignity. So there's something for everyone. There's something for the warlords, and there's something for the people who get oppressed by those warlords.
There's another subtext here that emerges in both the Shadow of the Sword and in Millennium. That is the notion of peace located in the centre of the imperial gift. That in the Christians had to struggle with that. At some point in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, the notion of the peaceful kingdom, which had benefited a civilizational spread of Christianity, becomes problematic.
Well, it's a horror. I mean, it's an absolute horror. The violence and the savagery and the brutality that racks France and Italy and the whole of Europe in the early Middle Ages is something horrendous. And it becomes staggering in that context that a religion triumphs, which says that you should love your enemy and that you should turn the other cheek, and that essentially pacifism is the best course. You know, it is a landscape full of violent warriors. It's Mad Max. And yet somehow this religion succeeds in posing a measure of order that gets into the heads of people.
Pax Christiana becomes...
Yeah, Pax Christiana. And the same happens in the Middle East with Islam, that, as I've been describing, the landscape of the Middle East in the 7th and 8th centuries is horrendous. It's racked by plague and war and bandits, and it makes Iraq now look like a tea party. And yet what emerges out of this is a religion and an order and a civilization that enables people to survive, and not only to survive, but to thrive. And so I see both of them. I see the establishment of a sort of an Islamic order, an Islamic civilization in the Middle East, and a Christian civilization in the West, as two of the great achievements of humankind.
We've got to wind this up. But a year or so ago, Bettany Hughes, the British historian, made an observation in a lecture that she thought that civilizations were marked by sort of gifts, if you like, that they give to history, that what Christianity has given was, and she used a very powerful word, compassion, that this idea that the state has to be mediated by a sense of individual dignity and justice. And she used the word compassion as a sort of latch key in which you could understand a pivot point for Christianity. Do you think that's a reasonable way of approaching things, to look at gifts that civilizations
give? I do, because one of the things that the process of writing about both classical civilization and then about monotheistic civilization has given me is a sense that everything that I am, everything that my friends are, everything that the society in which I live, and everything that the West is, so Australia, Britain, and the whole of the West, is shaped far more by Christianity than by classical civilization. And you're right that something like compassion does sum that up, because for all the crimes that Christian society has inflicted, and of course they've been monstrous, nevertheless, there has always been the consciousness lurking in the minds of most people that they were crimes. To the Romans, that they weren't crimes, they were causes for celebration. And maybe something that sums that up is a difference in Roman history. Julius Caesar, when he conquers Gaul, is said to have slaughtered a million Gauls and to enslaved another million. This is not a cause for apology. This is a cause for celebration. It's boasted about in the triumphs. Go a thousand years on, and there's still a Roman Empire based in Constantinople, even though we call it the Byzantine Empire. As far as the people in Constantinople were concerned, it remained the Roman Empire that Julius Caesar had belonged to. It's a Christian empire. And there is a general called Nikephoros who becomes an emperor. And he has fought against the Muslims, and he is aware that the Muslims have this notion that if you die in battle, you will go to heaven as a martyr. And this obviously is very encouraging for people who are fighting. And so he goes to the patriarch in Constantinople and he says, hey, what about it? Could you give my guys something like that? And the patriarch turns around, and not only does he say, no, I'm not going to do that, but he says that anyone who kills, even if it's in defence of, you know, a church, even if it's defence of the Christian empire of the new Rome, Constantinople, we'll have to do 3 years penance. And that is a very profound moral and ethical transformation. And I think that in that transformation, you get some sense of what Christianity brought to Western civilization.
Tom Holland's been fascinating talking to you. We could follow some of the threads you've drawn out of your books for many hours, but we have run out of time. Thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thanks for having me.
Historian Tom Holland, author of Persian Fire, Rubicon, Millennium, and most recently, The Shadow of the Sword. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.